Welcome to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. And today we have crew, illustrious crew.
Rob Fields here, back in effect.
See,
in the house.
I like that. Comes in with the full Barry White right out of the gate.
In full effect.
In full effect. Super producer Matt Luck is here, everybody, in full effect. Phil, what's the brand F-Up of the week?
The brand F-Up comes to us from Washington, D.C. As several young teens, it's important to mention that these teens were African-American, so they were some colored folk, were selling water on the D.C. Mall, which for those who are not familiar with D.C. is pretty much a long stretch, about 2 miles, maybe a little bit more, where all the major monuments are, the Smithsonian, Capitol Building stretches on one end to the Lincoln Memorial down on the other. So you get a sense of where these young men were. They were handcuffed and arrested for selling water, basically vending without a license. Though they were not charged, this did cause quite a bit of controversy on social media very recently, as pictures of them being handcuffed and held were pretty widely circulated. Now, given the normal state of law enforcement in this country, I'm not sure if this is a strict brand F-up in the normal sense, in the sense that this is pretty much law enforcement acting as law enforcement does, which is to criminalize black bodies. But I guess in the larger sense of philosophy, it is a brand F-up to criminalize young people basically selling water, permit or no permit.
Yeah, I mean, I won't say this to sort of like play the, you know, the olive branch position here, but I've definitely talked to people who are both involved in policing now and are retired in policing, and you know, I mean, just like the most basic perspective that they say that type of building kind of like basic positive interactions with, by the way, any community is like essential to doing the job. So even if you have any seriousness about any type of kind of positive output on the job, you know, it is a brand F up. And I also want to juxtapose it with, I guess, another brand F up, which is these new classes that are getting deployed in New Jersey, which are basically like teaching kids, and of course it's kids of color, how to deal with cops, but from a police perspective, from like a you treat us with endless respect and deference perspective, which is, you know, fucked up because of a story like this innately, because, you know, you have to give respect to get respect, and also constitutionally dangerous because you actually need to be teaching young people like how to protect your rights, which are not a given, obviously. So, you know, I just... It's so constant, and I feel like we've highlighted this in so many different ways, but because it's unending. And now, you know, we had very modest reforms under the last administration, and now we have an administration where from the top, there's a cosign on this.
I don't know. I don't have that much to add on this except to say that, you know, I love the spirit of brand F-ups and this section of Two Dope Boys, but, you know, I think it's important to note that, you know, brand F-ups are for, you know, real fuck-ups. This is a feature, not a bug of policing. Right. And so in that regard, it's not a brand F-up. It's very much on point for police brands broadly. You know, to criminalize activity that, you know, there was a guy on Twitter who was like, my kids sell water all the time. I'm white and they never get harassed by the cops.
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, it's just once again, cops overreacting. I mean, what's going to happen next? You know, they're going to start arresting kids who in the middle of winter go up and down the street offering to shovel snow without a permit. I mean,
yeah, it's quite possible.
It's just kind of dumb. And, you know, once again, we are reminded that, you know, black bodies are inherently criminal. And, you know, we were talking about before the show started, the book Stamp from the Beginning. And it's all kind of a piece of a larger, you know, problem with America. But let's move on.
That's what it is. That's the brand F up. That's America's F up. Let's get to what's up. Now we're going to go to What's Up, and we're going to actually fuse a couple of stories from the Silicon Valley new economy beat that we didn't get to in the past couple of weeks. And one is a kind of act of attempt at a brand salvation in the form of Uber finally getting rid of Travis Kalanick. He is so aptly named, and yet I can never remember his name. There's an interesting sort of mythos to that. And so really, you know, you have this sort of brand that's kind of come through a fusion of, and I think it's important we talk about Uber. There's problems that Uber represents innately that are reflected in all of these platforms, whether they're Lyft or anything else. And that's the sort of casualization of work, the movement towards, you know, in fact, a driverless future, and the fact that all of these people are getting sold a bill of goods on a new type of employment are going to be obsolete as soon as these companies can get there. And with the exception of Juno, they're very underpaid. And that's a broad kind of problem that all of these platforms have. And then Uber made a name for itself by having an incredibly obnoxious CEO and having a sexual harassment problem that spanned it from the executive and engineering level, but actually also of women drivers. I interviewed Avi Shapiro of Intercept on Majority Report. He did a piece on women Uber drivers who were harassed. And, you know, the response to engineers who were harassed at Uber was terrible. You could imagine how drivers were treated when reporting this. So there's this sort of top level action at Uber in attempt to kind of salvage their brand and kind of pitting their problems on Kalanick. Then we have the Amazon acquisition of Whole Foods, which is interesting in a couple ways. I mean, one, it's the sort of next logical deployment of monopoly capitalism in the digital age, and that's obviously always been kind of Amazon's sort of a long-term plan. And it, you know, brought Whole Foods back in the headlines because Whole Foods had really, I mean, lost its luster recently. Its profits were down for the past several quarters, and I think that there's something now for Whole Foods as a brand in a America that's a little bit more aware of inequality, a little bit more skeptical of kind of scams and branding and bullshit. Whole Foods somehow went from, you know, the kind of like organic upstart for people who really cared about health food to basically a sort of, you know, obnoxious status symbol, which didn't help itself. And the last thing I'll add to that is, you know, now Whole Foods, marginally compared to other companies in a similar category, did treat its employees marginally better, though crackdown on unionization efforts. But now with Amazon, we'll see what happens when the Amazon kind of, you know, factory sweatshop model and efficiency is applied at least to Whole Foods distribution centers. That might mean a whole different reality for Whole Foods workers. So that's the kind of big picture update of the big players in the Silicon Valley universe, monopolies, brands, CEOs, and the future of work. We're just going to kind of take a little tour through that. So start wherever you gentlemen want.
Yeah, I think the through line to both these stories is the comfort level that all of these industries have with basically predatory capitalism. Mm-hmm. And as if there's any other kind, I guess to say predatory capitalism is just to double up on the terminology. And I'll take Uber first in the sense that Kalanick leaving the job to me is way overdue. We've talked about this on the show repeatedly, that the Uber model is basically a Ponzi scheme built on exploitation. And it's the sensationalist but yet important cultural story of Uber's been getting all the attention, as it does deserve to have a huge amount of attention. And we covered this with Susan Fowler's letter,
right,
that sort of became the moment where all of a sudden people really started to pay attention to this. But Uber has no pathway to being a profitable company. Their business can't really even be a classic monopoly in the sense that there's a low barrier to entry. their rides are heavily subsidized by the fact that they've raised so much money from private investors that turned their eye to a history of terrible behavior until it became untenable to do so, only because they want to bring the Ponzi scheme to full fruition, which is an IPO moment. And anything that would interfere with that or get an IPO at a valuation that they didn't perceive to be high enough to get their money out, which is all of this is built on the greater fool theory, we're going to pump money into it, pump up the valuation, and then get our money out due to IPO moment. That was a threat. And so all of a sudden, Kalanick now became persona non grata. So All the people patting themselves on the back and writing stories about, could this be the moment that Silicon Valley has turned the corner toward realizing that, you know, women and people of color and just general human decency should be baked into these companies. I call bullshit on that. I don't think that this...
There may be a moment they've become a little bit more brand aware. Like, it makes me think, like, I don't know if Steve Jobs could get away with in real time the type of abuse he got away with back when he was CEO. Not because of a moral change, but just because of a communications and brand change. I think maybe. That's part of it. Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah. I think to a certain extent the sort of abuse that Jobs was known for is also a function of this sort of, you know, grind till you die, hustle,
right.
I'm a mercurial genius,
yeah,
as opposed to the sort of just basic infringement on all things legal that were part of the Uber mantra. Like they built this on ignoring local, you know, taxi and livery laws. You know, they tried to shirk federal regulation using that gray ball technology. Like they've constantly been breaking any and all rules in order to establish themselves as a business.
Definitely.
You know, and I think that through line again is that anything goes as long as you're getting toward the IPO moment. And Amazon on the other side of that is allowed, again, the terrible labor regulations because we want 2-day delivery.
Right.
You know?
A couple things about this. I think you guys are making, as usual, some really great points, so I'm not going to repeat any of those. I think some lessons I take away from... lessons or cautions, I'll say, that I take away from both of these are as follows. Uber, I think, is an important reminder to us, particularly at this moment, that consumers can vote with their dollars and it can have an impact. Part of the reason Kalanick had to leave was that their profits and stock prices were falling.
Yeah.
I mean, their stock, they didn't go public. I don't think.
Public,
yeah, but their business was seeing reduced earnings over a time that made their investors nervous. It is an important reminder that we as regular people, if we band together, we can make some change. The other piece of that, though, is that it does take time. It took the Susan Fowler letter. It took the video of Kalanick berating an Uber driver. It took Uber and Lyft, I should say, breaking the strike at JFK during the first Muslim travel ban, all that and consumers using the delete Uber hashtag and actually deleting Uber and not using it has brought us to this moment. So is the company more chastened? I have no idea, but it is great to see that people just broadly are just like, nah, we're not going to keep giving you money if you're going to keep being a bunch of dude bros and mistreating women and all that stuff. And
dude bros, the fuck is your problem?
You know. So that's one thing. So that's a positive out of that. So if we take one lesson from the Uber thing is, yes, mass consumer action can have an impact. It might take time, though. So manage your expectations accordingly. Amazon makes me think of, you know, this is, you know, great. Prices should come down in Whole Foods, aka Whole Paycheck. Wonderful.
Classic.
But the thing that also stands out is with Amazon consuming more and more of people's discretionary income and being that go-to sort of company for everything you need, from food to clothing to entertainment and media. Are a couple things going to happen? Are we going to see a further demarcation of those who have and who don't? Like, are we going to be not just a culture and a country of have and have nots, but who of people who have and don't have Prime? Like, are you going to get preferential treatment for a whole lot of things because you're a Prime member? Oh, and totally. You just sort of take that as, gee, that's the way it's supposed to go. A larger question also is, does being enmeshed in such a large and all-encompassing, you know, consumer bubble of, you know, again, being able to get movies and have your food delivered, and Prime Now gets you, you know, your food delivered in like 2 or 3 hours or something like that, you know. I think we have to fight against the sort of the narcotic effect of that, because I worry that that sort of takes our eyes off what's going on in the real world in terms of, you know, how we're looking at things politically and socially, and are we just sharing bits of, you know, content and feedback on among each other, our fellow Amazon Prime users, like we talk to each other on Twitter and all that stuff, but. So much more of our life is wrapped up, can be wrapped up in Amazon, because they are making a play to just make your life convenient, which on its surface, not a bad thing, but we know what human nature can tend towards. So
there's a cost to everything.
Yeah.
I mean, my only final thought on this, I'm going to jump to you, is that I just think, though, that, you know, in the short term, Whole Foods prices will go down. But in the long term, I mean, I think we also need to realize that, you know, if we've completely dropped any sense of controlling monopolies, and ultimately that does not, you know, I mean, maybe monopolies will choose to hold prices down for their own, you know, reasons, but there's all sorts of, and they can do whatever they want. I mean, ultimately, if there isn't a governance model, if there isn't a 21st century consumer bill of rights, if there isn't and, you know, these companies have created platforms which have been privatized from the beginning, and that has incredibly dangerous implications for, and I think also, you know, speaking as and I love beating up on capitalism, it also has very dangerous implications for who has space to bring a new product to market. I mean, each margin is getting cornered, right? And so, you know, the long-term play of Amazon eating up this much more space, that could very well be higher prices.
It's not good. We already saw the effects of what happened when Walmart came to town.
Exactly.
You know, it just destroyed mom and pop, you know, grocery retail. And, you know, Amazon is the one company in the position of being able to compete by taking a loss.
Right.
Whereas your local bodega needs to make money every, you know, the local key food needs to make money every month. You know, so they can keep the lights on and pay employees. Jeff Bezos can afford to take a loss for years on end to gain market share.
I think when and it's interesting, the monopoly point, because traditionally when people fear monopoly, it's largely due to price. If one looks at antitrust legislation from 1890s through to now, it's usually that, you know, the consumer will have less options and prices will then go up. Amazon has traditionally avoided the same type of anti-monopoly legislation because prices have tended to trend down when they are the principal actor in a particular market or providing a service. I think we have to begin to reimagine what a monopoly is, because it will no longer be solely based on the up and down price pressure.
It'll be on market share.
Yeah, it'll be on a function of market share. It will also be throughout the supply chain. I think we're still trying to really figure out what digital landscapes truly mean as it pertains to just market share totally when you look at the entire supply chain of what one company can offer as opposed to others. And I think that's the direction that folks have got to look at. You know, it's less about what this one particular deal will mean and more function of what does all of this look like 10 to 15 years down the line. Again, playing that longer game. And just from a personality perspective, you know, someone like a Jeff Bezos, I'm always skeptical at how quickly all of these tech and Silicon Valley guys lined up to be a, part of the new regime's machine. And this came up when we spoke to Neil Dash. It's come up in, other bits of conversation that for all their branding and messaging about being different and being focused on a, kinder, gentler human perspective and changing the world, and we're looking to be unicorns and all the branding language, these guys are, right there in line to promote their agenda, which is just more for them and less for all of us.
The other thing that I think it's worth talking about too is just from a standpoint of, you know, how this impacts the whole discussion about entrepreneurship. So if Amazon is pushing out local grocers the way that Walmart did, because everybody can just pull up an app on their smartphone, you know, what does that mean for somebody who would have, say, started a business that was in grocery or something like that, or taken over their parents' bodega, you know? Or do you need to be a coder with an MBA in order to be an entrepreneur in a future where Amazon owns everything?
I would say, and probably not even entrepreneur, probably just look for a cog in a monopoly machine. So, I mean, and that's also where, you know, again, all of the class dimension of this stuff comes in. So that's what's up. Uber, the change isn't structural. Amazon, the Whole Foods merger might be late on your wallet in the short term, but heavy on your everything in the long term. That's what's up. We got to get to what's next.
Now we want to jump into what's next, and what you're hearing a little bit is PopCon and DeVito, My Story. And we're going to use that as a little bit of a teaser, a hint, because we've talked a lot about music on the show. That's a reoccurring trend. But very early on in our time on the air, we did a, story around the influences of soca music and Afrobeat music, and that, and this what would be classically known as world music becoming basically the sound of pop music generally. And the song you guys just heard, which again is PopCon and DeVito. DeVito is a West African artist, primarily in Afrobeat. PopCon is a newer reggae artist who's had tons of songs with many artists, most recently Jamie XX, just to name one, who had a, really big pop song last summer. And you know, hearing the sound, the song, you get a sense of how, again, you have a huge reggae artist combining with one of the largest Afrobeat West African artists and coming up with yet another hit song. This has pretty much been released about 2-3 weeks ago. And if you take this if you take this and flip it over and you look at the Luis Fonsi song, Daddy Yankee, Justin Bieber, Despacito has been number one for what, 5-6 weeks now? The first Spanish language song to be number one since the Macarena, which was awful. So we've at least gotten better in our taste when it comes to Spanish language songs becoming number one. But again, I think we're seeing more and more of, you know, our thoughts around Afrobeat, soca music, reggae music becoming pop music, you know. And again, this is something we talked about a year ago. And this trend continues to solidify. And it's a perfect way to segue into a larger conversation about how these sounds, these people who are contributing in this, how they're becoming really the sound of the future, the present and the future.
You know, what's interesting to me mostly with this music is just given that, you know, these songs are coming out, you know, this PopCon song, just as you pointed out, came out 2-3 weeks ago as of this recording. The Despacito came out in its earliest form in January. But they are seeping through all the cracks in culture, even as we live in a world that's turning to the right and trying to sort of reassert sort of the primacy of like a dominant white American culture. And it's just, and in that way, it's
right.
In that way, it's just encouraging because it's like that can't stop, won't stop stuff. You know, it's just, you know, as much as, you know, reactionary forces try to make things neat and tidy and recognizable for them, these new sort of cultural creations from black and brown people keep coming, and they keep changing and impacting the culture. And so that is heartening. And now we just need the sort of the political, our political abilities to keep up with our culture defining abilities, and we'll be in a good place.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that,
of course, because I said it.
Oh, damn. Rob, I like it. I saw a little bit of myself in Rob right there. I think that, I think, you know, to me, what I like about this too is I think that it's a national, you know, if you, you know, for me, just speaking in kind of a personal taste level, for whatever reason, I've always been very particularly partial to reggae generally and really very broadly. And I do also and have experience with soca. And, you know, that's always been in my kind of sound palette. And I think if you live in New York, and very specifically if you live in certain parts of Brooklyn, this is your music. It's seamlessly integrated with any other kind of pop music you could name. So this kind of spreading out is a nationalization to some extent of, you know, what just on a really simple level is just great music. And I would say American music in the broad sense that, you know, this is all the Americas and the Caribbean and, you know, Latin America. We're all in the same neighborhood and we're all connected through a lot of different currents. And it's cool to see it kind of externalized and embraced by the culture. Yeah, I mean, Sinead was talking about her work with Mad FX, and, you know, she was talking about having an activist perspective but wanting to put out some really joyful music, and that kind of brought her to Trinidad. And the interesting thing to me about that range coming from that sound is, you know, there's certainly, especially, you know, if you get into dance hall, there's some of the most kind of, if that's your thing, there's some of the most, and it can be my thing, some of the kind of most ruthless, vicious kind of lyrics imaginable. There's, you know, we're going to have the best party music imaginable. We're up at, you know, 5 a.m. and it's still beautiful outside and we're enjoying ourselves. And then there is actually, you know, also linking to what you said, Rob, there's obviously a lot of politics in all this music. And it's, you know, and it's definitely not just, I mean, very much it's Bob Marley if we're going to talk in Jamaica, but it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's across the entire genre and very much so in those other forms too, just like, I guess, analogous with gangster rap, which actually did in its sort of origins actually have a politics to it in some ways. So, you know, maybe it will start to catch up more formally. You know, the sound also has a politics and a point to it, and it is counterbalanced with, you know, the political trend. So those forces are contrasting and heightened right now, but they might start to clash, and that would be a good thing. And meanwhile, you know, commercials and everything else will sound cooler.
And I think we're also starting to see that the advent of the playlist as curation, if you look at Spotify playlist as example, that's where people are really discovering their music. And mm-hmm. It has the amount of reach that a service like Spotify can have to hone in on songs and sounds and artists that are global, and then bring those artists to your attention in the way that you know, even those of us that are most in tune to music and diving for albums, you know, playlists have now broken the album model where you were waiting for a particular artist and you were waiting to hear like everything they produced. The very top echelon artists, I think, still have that sort of cachet where they drop an album and it's an event. But so much of these singles, particularly the ones that encompass this type of sound, they exist solely as one piece of work. They're a single, or they exist in the larger palette of a playlist. It's less about, you know, are you going to go out and buy every other thing that, you know, a Luis Fonsi might do, or are you just looking for that single remix with a Justin Bieber on it?
Right.
You know, and Justin Bieber is another one of these artists, and I think Diplo with Major Lazer is another example of that, where they're continuously putting out music. That cycle of, I'm going to make an album, disappear for a year or two, and then come back and make another album is pretty much dead.
Yeah.
You know, between you appearing on people's work, promoting your own singles, like Justin Bieber as an artist has been on a continuous run for like 3-4 years.
I think to be a little bit more precise is important, and I think that it's dead for artists who are trying to appeal to a younger demographic, i.e. anybody under 35. I think an Adele can always go away and put out an album, and there's a demographic that's going to like be like, sure, I will have an album, you know, and I'll put out an album. But yeah, I think for artists who are of that under 35 generation, I think you're exactly right that it's really about just putting stuff out, throwing it against the wall, you know. And, you know, Spotify playlist, you know, this is an aside, but there was a fantastic article, and I'll send this link to Matt if you didn't see it. It's called The Secret Life of Playlists. Hmm. Which just really goes kind of behind the scenes into how Spotify playlists get made. Wow. And they're pretty much, it's payola again in the record business. So that's a whole other story. But
everything old is new again.
Yeah, because there's no such thing, there's no prohibition against payola for digital music.
Oh, well, the workaround.
Of course not. The workaround. That's the whole, that's the conversation. There's no prohibition against anything in this digital space because these companies have hustled us to pretend they're something different. That's the Amazon conversation all over again.
Yeah.
That's what's up. Got to get to the crates. All right, so now we got to get to the crates, and I'm going to give everybody a pound as I leave, as I realize I'm late for something. So we get there fast. This is a pick from culture. You know what it is. I'm going to pick something. This might be a stretch, but I just want to put it out there. I think our conversation that came out last week with Alnora kind of inspired me. If you have the opportunity, go on a 10-day meditation retreat. I would recommend that. I've done a number of them. For me specifically, I've gone to the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, which teaches a form of mindfulness Vipassana meditation. It's, you know, it's a Buddhist place, but it's definitely very light on any type of, you can go there from any type of background, religiously or non-religiously, and you'll feel fine with it. And you'll get taught a method, which I think is worth doing. I think it gives you a door into a different type of way of kind of being in yourself and being in the world. And I do think it has relevance for our time. So if you have an opportunity to do something like that, I want to throw out the potential for having that experience. It was awesome having another ride with you guys. And I'll see you all very soon.
Cool. Thank you. Peace and be out.
Peace.
I got two quick links that I found just to be historically super interesting. One of them is not produced well, so I'm going to kind of shit on this even as I'm recommending it. But for those of us who came up in the 90s and remember Atlanta Freaknik, this is an online documentary that was posted on TopBuzz.com created by Ladysmith111. I'm not sure who this person is, but it kind of came across my timeline, and it's a documentary in the loosest sense of the word of the 90s Freaknik Atlanta story. And Freaknik was this amazing, yet also toward the end, crazy ratchet event.
Decadent.
Yeah. Decadent is a nice way of putting it, where folks, you know, college kids primarily, but pretty much everybody swarmed Atlanta and took it over for a weekend. And it pretty much put Atlanta on the map for a lot of folks like myself that was, you know, born New Yorker, wasn't really fucking with the South. Like, that exposure, being at Howard, meeting Atlanta kids, and then going to Freaknik in the 90s was like, damn, Atlanta is wild. And again, this is a terrible documentary in the sense that it's kind of amateur, and they talk to no women, and really the exploitation of women is one of the main things that kind of shut Freaknik down, that it just became out of control. The harassment was crazy. You know, we was living in different times, but still it was off the hook, terrible. And throughout this entire thing, they talked to no women to get their perspective on what Freaknik was all about. But it's still, for a piece of 90s nostalgia, is worth kind of taking a look at. And then I'm going to recommend a link that's on Genius. And I'm loath to recommend anything on Genius because they're culture vultures. But this is actually a pretty good thread that goes through, you know, late 80s and early 90s hip hop and just 90s goon thug life history. You know, all the names you hear about in dropped on Tupac songs and Bad Boy songs and early Jay-Z songs, all these like nefarious stick up kids and gangsters throughout New York history that was involved in all the beef between Death Row and Bad Boy and Tupac and Jay-Z battling with different crews. Mike Tyson shows up, like all these just great pictures and great stories. You know, some of it probably hearsay, some of it probably true, but it's just really interesting if you want to get a deeper understanding as to like who all these characters are that influenced and played a major role in 80s and 90s hip hop. This is a great link to kind of go through and waste some time on and track back through that music. So again, recommend this link on Genius, and we'll have it up on the show notes.
My link is I guess I sort of previewed my Digging in the Crates in that last segment, but this is the article from cashmusic.org on the Secret Life of Playlist, which is a phenomenal sort of investigation, and I don't want to make this an investigative journalist piece, but it really is a look, and because the author went and talked to a lot of people on both Spotify and the record labels about how their playlist systems work. And as we talk about monopolies and markets, we, you know, when we talk about music, we have to talk about Spotify, because they are by far you know, cornering the market on what we hear. It is not random. It is a mixture of some human curation, but very much largely algorithms that take note of what you listen to, what you like, what you save, how long you listen to things, and as well as what the major labels are willing to pay to get their songs on playlist. You know, and there's a hierarchy of playlist for bands, for
that Rap Caviar.
Yeah, Rap Caviar, it's expensive. You just don't end up on Rap Caviar. So this article sort of breaks it down and how it happens. And it's definitely worth the read, just so you can be a little bit more aware of how the machine is trying to manipulate you, and both for Spotify's own ends as well as for the for the purposes of the record labels.
That's it. Neo, Michael's already fled the building, but I want to thank, of course, Rob Fields for joining us, as always, core crew.
Back again.
Back again. It won't be the last time. Of course, super producer Matt Leck, Sean Awan, and we want to say peace. Peace to the gods and the earths. Rest in peace, Prodigy.
Yes. And rest in peace also, Jerry Allen, who just as this episode was getting started, found out that she passed away. Noted jazz pianist, part of the whole M-Bass Collective back in the day, and big loss for jazz and music culture overall.
And that's it. Peace.